Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to another episode of the Investors Chronicle Interviews podcast. Today, I'm joined by Hugh Young, Chair of Aberdeen's Asia Business and a man with over 35 years experience in Asian equity investing. Prior to his current role, Hugh was Head of Asia Pacific for Aberdeen Standard Investments. His career in the industry began in 1980, and his current duties also include management of the Aberdeen Asia Focus Investment Trust. As that biography implies, today we're going to be talking all things Asia Pacific, from economic concerns to company and sector specific topics, of course, with a healthy dollop of discussion on Chinese equities, Chinese companies doing business in China, and things like that too. We may also stray slightly further afield and touch on some of the other emerging markets as well. Hugh, welcome to the show. You're joining us from Singapore. How's life over there?
Thanks for that, Dan. I'm rather pleasant in the afternoon here, so at least I can still wear T-shirt and shorts.
Yeah, a luxury no longer available to us over here, but such is life. It is quite refreshing, you know, as a UK-based journalist to be talking about something other than the UK today. So let's get straight into it. But in keeping perhaps with the topics of interest over here, the topics of interest for emerging markets, Asia-Pacific, at the moment, they're also quite macro-focused, it seems to me. Whether you're a stock picker or a top-down investor, there's perhaps no avoiding the question at the moment, you know, of the US dollar and the impact that's having on all other economies, really. Or from your perspective, you think of the dollar, you know, how do you see its strength affecting the business case for emerging market Asia Pacific equities in general? Is this something, as an Asia Pacific investor, you just have to wear and to, you know, navigate around and things like that? Or is it something you think is not actually so big an issue when you're looking at individual companies and stocks?
I certainly don't think it's the biggest issue at the moment. The really big issues are, of course, are we in recession or not? Or certainly going that way, rising interest rates, rising inflation, commodity prices, and those are every bit as big as the US dollar. And frankly, it depends on the companies we're investing in. So when we look at equities, you know, some benefit from the strong dollar, or rather are not hurt too badly by it. It depends where their sales are, where their business is, etc. But generally, it's yet another headwind, I'm afraid, at a time when on the macro front, that's all we seem to be seeing. There are very few tailwinds whatsoever. There's just a very, very strong headwind.
Well, let me try maybe sort of join some of the dots between that point and the points you very rightly raise. You know, one EU diplomat said this week, Fed hiking, which of course is causing the stronger dollar and is, you know, causing interest rates to rise around the world. The diplomat said the Fed hiking cycle is risking a global recession. Is that, you know, your point of view? You know, how do you factor in these cycles when you're looking again on a company stock specific basis?
Yeah, again, I think the diplomat's quite correct, and I think it's clear to most people that at the very least we risk entering a recession if we haven't done so already. So the economic outlook is pretty cloudy. Things in Asia are slowing quite dramatically, or have slowed dramatically. Primarily China, of course, as the big growth engine of the last few decades. So that's slowed right down. And you're seeing that happen throughout the Asian market. So in some senses, Asia is, I would say, no different to what we're seeing in the UK in the broad themes. But of course, I would say it's far more resilient than the UK. So it has some underlying strengths as well. The long-term strengths that we've seen coming out of Asia again for many, many years. But my goodness, we're in some pretty savage cycles over the period as well.
Do you when you sort of think back on your career and you think of the current moment, does this seem a familiar moment? Does it recall other times, and do you draw lessons from those periods?
Yes, and one of the biggest lessons, of course, is to do our homework on the companies, and often that comes down to the balance sheet. I mean, I always liken it to the rock on which you build rather than building on sand, because when something drops away, which we've seen it happen so many times over the 30 years I've been based in Singapore, from often when you least expect it, if you don't have that balance sheet, you're absolutely dead and taken out. So saying, I would say this current situation is not nearly as bleak as the Asian crisis or anything like that, that was very specific to Asia. I mean, I think as far as I can work out, as far as my best guess is, we're ultimately seeing the unwinding of all the loose money that we've seen for the last 10, 15, 15 years or so.
You mentioned a balance sheet there, and let's talk about maybe some company-specific factors briefly. How much, you know, are you concerned by things like, you know, debt on balance sheet, particularly in interest rates, you know, a cycle of rising interest rates, things like cash flow, of course, very important at the moment. Is it the kind of the obvious things you look for? Are there slightly more nuanced factors you look for when looking at balance sheets as well?
Well, we start with the obvious. So, yes, how much debt, if any? And what's interesting, at the fund I look after, Asia Focus, on a see-through basis, the companies are actually sitting on net cash. So that shows really how much attention we do pay to things like balance sheets, because certainly when economies slow, obviously cash flows slow as well. And then a combination of that with higher interest rates will destroy any of the weaker companies. So I think it's very important in our analysis and going as deep as possible on debt and what companies get up to. Some of the more naughty companies can do some very peculiar things with their balance sheets, and we try and avoid those like the plague.
How does that lead you to particular sectors in Asia Pacific? I know the Asia Focus Fund is small cap focused, but in general, these principles, do you find yourself looking more often than not at certain sectors?
We probably generally steer clear of certain sectors. So heavily cyclical sectors is not our comfort zone. So we prefer more traditional sectors, so some of the local finance stocks, for example, local banks, etc., might not be the most dynamic of growth, but again, can be a great way to enjoy the long-term development of an economy. Again, making sure that we stick with the most conservative banks with the soundest lending policies, but it will be a whole mix. Technology represents a fair chunk of our portfolio. Consumer goods, similarly, a big chunk. Manufacturing, a big chunk. So a whole variety, trying to find leaders in every sphere. So we don't put all our eggs into one basket. That's a lesson sort of well learned over the years. So we have a spread both of geography and of businesses.
Just on banks, I mean, obviously a question for investors in banks in any region of the world right now is, you know, how much will the benefit of rising rates offset the risk of you know, that recession brings in terms of bad debts, bad loans? You talk about obviously wanting to look at the more conservative lenders. Are there countries, areas where you feel that dynamic is particularly difficult in terms of finding banks, financials that can come out on the upside from that equation?
Yeah, that's the balance. The interest rates rising, of course, helps banks, but at the same time, in a recession, you get a slew of bad debt. It can be very difficult in China. I think looking at financial stocks in China is not easy, given what's going on in China. And the transparency is not there nearly as much as, say, here in Singapore, where you've got a really strong regulator that's seen the banks through many, many regional global crises. And haven't really had any major hiccups whatsoever. So very strong capital adequacy, very strong rules. Again, we can find banks similar to the Singaporean banks scattered around the region. Some in India are very strong. Even the Philippines has some strong banks, so it's really bank by bank understanding the culture, as well as the regulations.
China, you know, there's an array of issues we can talk about there. So let's go into it. Let's start with, you know, real estate. This was an issue that, from perspective of perhaps us in the UK, was, you know, bubbling under for a long time. Sort of came to a head with the Evergrande issue, things like that, and perhaps has taken a backseat to various other world events from the UK investors' perspective in recent months. But how do you see that you know, unfolding, or perhaps popping of the real estate bubble? Is that continuing? Is that a fair characterization? You know, how is that sector developing this year?
And I think it is a fair characterization. So what we've feared for some time has been coming true. So we've been visibly seeing companies going bust. We still see quite a bit of pressure on the property sector. So even within our dedicated China funds, we have fairly small exposure, again, concentrating on the best financed property companies. But it still is an issue. And that's an underlying concern behind my earlier comments on Chinese banks and transparency. You're not quite sure what's going on. And there's been a lot of shadow lending as well. So it goes quite deep. I don't think it's going to blow up China as a whole, because China's very well organized. It's all centrally governed, so the banks all come under the party, and as do the property companies. So I think they'll see their way through it. But is it going to be a tricky area for particularly foreign investors? Well, and local investors, yes. And you've seen that in the property stock fixed income sector, where the debt has been massively derated.
What needs to happen for that to become a less of a problem? Because again, it seems to have been, you know, going on for years in various forms. Obviously, the government there, you know, the Communist Party, it's not really in its interest to let the whole thing collapse. Understandably, but you know, what is the solution? Is there one to, you know, making the sector more stable again?
Well, ultimately, it will be the government taking the sector over, or squeezing the heavily indebted companies, making sure that their principals walk away with absolutely nothing. And as you're aware, in China, often a lot worse than that, they might well end up in jail, or even worse than that. It does happen. So I think there'll be a big state intervention if we get that far. But it's the good news is that it is starting to happen. So we knew it was beneath the surface probably best part of 10 years that there's been such a boom. And of course, there have been some bad building practices, bad lending practices, and some companies took on a huge amount of debt, such as Evergrande.
We're recording this on Friday, the 14th of October. By the time it comes out next week, the party congress will have begun, and obviously that typically is an event that investors look to perhaps more in hope than expectation of you know, some changes and issues being resolved. Do you think that's the kind of thing that, you know, once that's done with, that these kind of issues, the nettle can be grasped, so to speak?
Not sure the party congress itself will sort of be that turning point, because I think the nettle's already starting to be grasped. But I suspect, and China can always surprise, but I suspect the congress itself will be largely a formality. Welcoming Xi Jinping into his third term. I think an important consequence of it might well be that we'll see the COVID restrictions being eased. China might turn out to be a bit more relaxed, because they've been really sort of panicky about COVID. Whether that happens, that'll be the interesting thing to see. And that will be obviously, that will be a bit of a nice tailwind for markets, because we've certainly seen the effect of COVID restrictions easing in the rest of Asia has been quite a positive. And if that can happen in China too, great. But again, I'm not holding my breath.
I was about to ask about the COVID restrictions and whether the zero COVID policies might change. It sounds like from your comment at the end there, you're not positioning with this in mind, but maybe, you know, pre-positioning or starting to consider it as something to look at in the next few weeks if there are signs there of an easing, perhaps.
Yes, but it will ease. We just don't know when. But even before that, we've been inclined to put a bit more money into China. Simply because the stock market has been so badly hit. It was a favourite, 18 months ago, but now has completely tumbled after China introduced various regulations. So that scared people. Then all the COVID stuff, the economy slowing, the property market. It's actually thrown up some pretty decent value.
When we spoke about balance sheets earlier, I think they sort of form part of your 10 golden rules, as it were. And another one of those rules, number one, in fact, is, you know, demanding fair treatment of shareholders. So when you invest in China with that in mind, and given the points you mentioned, you know, about the regulatory intervention in a number of sectors of late, how do you kind of square those two things? How do you balance those?
And I actually think the regulatory intervention in many ways has been long overdue, because China owed its growth in large part just to letting people really go for it without any restrictions. So in certain sectors, there simply wasn't any regulation. So the regulation was overdue and is, I think in that sense, quite healthy. And I think we've seen the bulk of the really dramatic regulation come in. So to have those rules, I think, is sensible. More broadly on governance in China, yes, it can still be an issue. So companies do owe everything really to the party. I mean, it's enshrined in some of them in the memorandum and articles of association on many companies as being their duty. So there's always that at the back of one's mind. But again, you've seen a pretty professional class of business people emerge in China who understand how to do things correctly. So that's been encouraging. It's all been going in the right direction. But is it as nearly open and developed as other parts of the region? No, not yet. But then, my goodness, it has some fantastic companies doing some really interesting things.
So you don't think, some people viewed those episodes last year as making China uninvestable. I'm sure you don't think that, but you don't consider them to be sort of a backward step in terms of the indications they provide to global investors about the safety of doing business in the country. Or is it understandable some people see them that way, or do you think they've got the wrong end of the stick?
I can understand how they feel like that. If you were a holder in one of the education companies and you just find its business being wiped away, my goodness. But then if you stepped back and looked at the regulations, should there be certain regulations in place? Yes. Had China not regulated a few of the companies, some of the internet companies had got into the lending business without having to abide by any of the banking rules, for example. So these were clearly areas that needed to be tightened up. But yes, we are wary of government intervention, to be honest, in any market. And the closer you get to governments, and the Chinese government is very close to many businesses, that's where we get more wary, because governments are obviously acting for reasons other than shareholder value.
That maybe brings us on to, you know, the big tech companies in China, which perhaps are nowadays the most obvious and the most visible Chinese companies to external investors. You know, thinking of Tencent, Alibaba, Baidu, again, because they're, you know, national champions now in a way. The government is obviously quite close to them. At the same time, you know, valuations have been hit quite significantly for not just for China-specific reasons this year, but do they hold interest now, or is that a case of them being too difficult, too close to the hand of government?
I think they are of interest. Again, particularly as share prices have fallen, most have halved and more, down 70% from the highs in certain cases. And all the companies do have what we like, so strong balance sheets. They have far more of a utility-type business now, of course, with the regulation, which explains why they've fallen. But again, if you look at them as utilities, you're looking at companies on 10, 12 times earnings. Not too bad. Some exploring overseas ventures, some of the portfolio of other interesting little enterprises. So I think certainly for a China portfolio and as a bit of an Asian portfolio, those make every bit of sense.
If we sort of take a step back and think again, maybe from a UK investor's point of view or even a UK company point of view, obviously China is a huge market. It has been for many years. Do you see the events of the past few years, kind of the growth cool down, slow down, and perhaps something more significant there? Do you see that changing the way Western companies look to the region? Are they increasingly looking to other Asian economies, whether that be for manufacturing, whether that be for targeting markets, rather than thinking, oh, China is the place we must go to? Or is there still much as it ever was? The market is so big that it's still tough to ignore.
I mean, it is very tough to ignore because it is a massive, massive market. But I think recent geopolitical events, Ukraine, obviously, will have caused many companies to think twice about putting everything in any one country, and probably in particular when they think of China. Goodness, if something happens with Taiwan or anything, what do we do? And given the increased hostility from the US on areas ranging from semiconductor chips on, you're seeing a lot more risk come in that sense. So companies looking at other markets as well to set up, and still having massive facilities in China. But I think they've got to be very careful, which is a worrying thing from my, best part of 40 years. Well, yes, 40 years doing the job. It's been a tale of barriers coming down between countries, trade moving across border, and all we're seeing at the macro level is, of course, those barriers coming up and the world being more divided, which is not a healthy thing. And at extremes, ends in war.
Well, we'll come back to the barriers in a second, but I just want to touch on the Taiwan issue. As you rightly say, people are cognizant of that risk now, in light of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Does that kind of cast a shadow over Chinese investment in general from a point of view of a fund manager, where you think, well, if that did happen, that the onus could be on us and everyone to divest those positions? Is that something it's feasible to consider as an Asia Pacific investor, or do you just have to try and hope for the best?
I think in a sense, if you're a dedicated Asia investor, you have to try and hope for the best. I mean, in my career, there's been tensions between India and Pakistan, fears of possible nuclear war even there. So these do crop up from time to time. Clearly, China's one, not even foreign policy aim, because it's domestic policy, is to reunite the country. And they've been very single-minded about that since day one. And is Xi Jinping the type of man to want to see that happen on his watch? Yes, he is. And how will he do it? Or will he actually try it? I don't know. So it's a risk we have to live with. And of course, if it happens, something like that does happen at an extreme, we'll see world markets collapse. So I'm not sure you'll necessarily be any worse off in this part of the world, certainly short term.
But the other issue is China is so much more, even after everything the past few years, interwoven with global markets and global companies, that unwinding those relationships will be much harder, even though there is the Russia precedent set. So we will have to see, I suppose, or hopefully we won't see. But let's let's go back to trade. And you talked about, you know, the barriers going up. Obviously, we appear to be in an era of, if not quite deglobalization, then certainly not quite as globalized as we were. But are there Asian countries, you know, benefiting from this? You know, Vietnam perhaps is a name that comes up quite a lot. Are there countries which, you know, being able to take more of the pie now that some of those relationships are shifting and some countries are reconsidering how they do business?
Vietnam's certainly been one that's been bubbling away quite nicely for a while as an alternative manufacturing base, as well as being a large domestic economy. India's another case in point that's seeing a bit more investment come into it. And traditionally, India's been a bit of a bureaucratic nightmare and still is, but not nearly as bad as it used to be. So it's getting better, but not the easiest country in which to do business. And then you're seeing businesses really spread out throughout the region, even bits into the Indonesias of this world and Malaysias and Philippines. So countries are benefiting, but of course, would they benefit even more from a fully integrated world trade? Yes, I think they would.
Let's talk about India for a bit, because it seems to have been, from market performance terms, a rare bright spot this year. You know, market doing reasonably well, certainly for a UK-based investor, although you could say that. But a few markets, if you're a sterling-based investor. But when you look at India, what are the interesting companies? Where do they kind of fall there? And what do you think has sparked the interest this year? Is it something structural that's beneficial? Is it a bit more of a kind of cyclical, you know, upswing? How do you see both the market and the individual companies in India?
Well, there's some great companies in India across a variety of sectors. So it has some of the leading IT services companies like Infosys, TCS in the Tata Group, for example, some very strong financial institutions, HDFC, Kotak, some interesting pharmaceuticals, some interesting consumer stocks, and Unilever being a clear example. Unilever's Indian operations are listed. So there's some really good companies, some really good business qualities in India. The issue, as far as stock markets is concerned, is simply valuation. I mean, it's not a cheap market. And if you're a long-term investor, as we are, fine. We'll ride through it and see the long-term earnings growth that will justify today's valuations. But given the way it's held up, it's probably not a screaming buy compared to other markets. So saying the economy is doing relatively well, I mean, it's one of the more insulated domestic economies in the region, and apart from its exposure to global energy prices, which thankfully have come a bit off the boil. And of course, they're also buying Russian oil, which gives them a slight discount.
Wait, you mentioned energy, and that is obviously a concern for not just, as it sometimes feels, for European countries and European populaces, but is that something you're increasingly having to factor in on a company level as well? You know, the costs, you know, things like liquid natural gas is becoming more expensive in Asia, partly because Europe seems to be buying up a lot of the stocks ahead of winter. You know, is that something you're factoring into company-specific decisions now?
Yes, and it's squeezing margins, very simply put. And unless you find an energy pure play, which I guess as far as countries are concerned in this part of the world, that's Australia, which does have some first-class energy stocks and commodity stocks. But generally, we're seeing energy and commodities broadly as being a negative for most of the businesses in which we invest. It's leading to squeezed margins. We're also seeing a bit of wage pressure. So it's one of many things we look at and are concerned by. So you've got that combination, bit of wage pressure, input price pressures, and at the same time, the global economy is a bit weak. So not a good combination, but it sounds very depressing from a macro point of view. But then when we look at the companies, we're finding companies, as I said, net cash, 10 times earnings, 3, 4, even 5% yields. That's not bad. Not bad.
Let's talk about inflation. In some ways, I'm surprised it's taken us this long, but you know, input costs are rising. You know, there are wage concerns. These are big issues, obviously, in Europe and the US. In emerging markets in general, you know, they've been more persistent. It's less of a novel event. How do you see those costs right now compared with, you know, the past couple of decades? And again, are there lessons you draw off on what works and what doesn't in this kind of period? If indeed this period, from an inflationary point of view, is comparable to some of those previous periods in emerging markets.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it probably is a bit comparable. And certainly we've been through periods when we've seen very strong wage appreciation. I mean, in the early days, kind of China was a fraction of the price of Thailand, and companies moved lock, stock and barrel into China. Now Thailand is cheaper than China. And I think one of the key lessons we learn is to make sure companies are adding value. So we shy away from, we tend to shy away from commodity companies in general, because it can be a bit of a gamble just on where you think the commodity price is. But particularly we shy away from companies reliant on cheap labor, because people will always find an area that's cheaper. So you've really got to look for companies adding value and having that ability to really keep their margins as high as possible. You know, we wish they'd all increase their margins, but that's not the reality of life. But just by keeping adding value and being the leaders in their sector means that they can continue to grow their profits, still while paying people more and more in wages and paying more for inputs, which they're having to do at the moment.
When you look at these issues, again, do they lead you to particular sectors, or is it just a case of, as you may be implying there, you know, the leaders in each sector in some ways, you know, the ones with pricing power, with the biggest economic moats?
Yeah, that's what we're looking at. Yes, certain sectors probably have easier pickings, maybe. So some of the purely domestic companies can be easier because they're in a more protected market. If you're a technology company operating on a global scale, you've got to be very fleet-footed because, of course, there'll be another technology company competing with you the other side of the world in a rapidly changing environment. And occasionally, we find companies that just seem to be able to adapt and continue doing an excellent job. And what comes to mind there is something like Taiwan Semiconductor, which has been a global leader for decades now, and we've held for decades. I mean, it's rare to find companies like that because market leaders can fade away and become overconfident and a bit lazy.
Semiconductors are an interesting topic right now. You know, obviously, there's been a chip shortage for a long time, you know, during and perhaps even slightly before the pandemic as well. Now, perhaps we're starting to see a situation where, you know, supply is increasing at the same time demand is reducing, to the extent we might see a bit of a glut right now. At the same time as that, you've also got, you know, the US and some of its industrial policy, shall we say, in terms of producing more of these things at home or trying to G up that side of things. How do all these things sort of affect the near medium term outlook for Taiwan semiconductor companies like that?
Yes, it's certainly hit their share prices quite badly, even though business is still at the moment quite strong. And you've seen quite a bit of weakness across the chip sector for precisely those reasons, combination of maybe eventually there being a glut, and of course the China tensions. And with that, you've seen share prices come rattling back to where they haven't been for ages. And yes, of course, it's a very cyclical sector, and I've lost track of how many cycles I've seen in it. And ultimately, you ride through them, and again, make sure you don't have all your eggs in one basket. But it's hard to beat anything of the quality of Taiwan semi, for example.
So does that mean in this kind of situation, you know, where prices have come off so much, that that's an area where you look to add more?
Yes.
Prices fall down.
Yep. We try and be counter-cyclical, if you like, having convinced ourselves that the business is a great long-term business. We use periods of weakness to top up, and of course, vice versa.
Yeah. Do you have sort of, when you look at companies in general, do you have set metrics or set caps? I'm thinking in terms of, you know, typical length of holding period is probably not something where you reach a certain time, say it's time to sell, but, you know, certainly size of the company, certainly price targets, things like that. Or do you tend to, you know, deal on a more ad hoc basis with individual company valuations?
Yes, we don't set price targets as such. I mean, we review the business and review the price on a regular, like say daily basis, but regular basis. And in the case of Taiwan Semi, we've held it for 20, 30 years, along with a few Indian holdings and Singapore holdings, etc. So all we're doing is looking at it as of today and seeing what the prospects are looking ahead 5 years. Our weighted holding period across portfolios is about 7 years. So we're not high turnover investors. We're what I like to think are genuine long-term investors making a commitment to a company, because we're not clever enough at guessing what areas are going to blow up in any given year.
Do you find nonetheless that, you know, years like this year, well, I suppose the last few years, difficult years, do lead to higher turnover levels as you know try and take advantage of lower prices, or is it just a case of, as you say, holding on to what you've got?
It's largely, again, holding on to what we've got, trying to take advantage of any market anomalies. And of course, the least easy part of the job is turning around to potential new investors saying, look, there's some great value on offer. Of course, it's at times like this that we find most people are sitting on their hands doing absolutely nothing, which is rather frustrating as an investor. But I find times like this is precisely when you should be putting money to work. You might assume you lose 10% very rapidly because that's the nature of markets, but really these are the times you should be putting money to work in markets, just dripping it in.
Yeah, and do you find new companies at moments like this when valuations come down? How is that kind of idea generation process working, you know, across the portfolios? Do you find more? Do you get the sense you're finding more opportunities right now in times of, you know, somewhat tumultuous times?
Yes, I think there are more opportunities. We have a team of, I have 40 colleagues out here in Asia on the equity side, looking at new companies, and there's always a trickle of new companies coming to market, as well as looking at existing listed companies. And of course, with share prices doing what they're doing, quite a few have come into the that interesting range where you think, oh yes, there's some here that we would be thinking of buying. Then the question obviously is whether they're better or cheaper than what we already hold. And that's the real acid test. So yes, in some cases, we've been taking a bit of money out of some things that have done very well and adding some new holdings that have come down to that buying level. So
we've been quite macro focused, or I have certainly my interest in during this chat, and maybe we can kind of conclude on when we look ahead, you know, the next few months, next few years, perhaps even. Do you consider things like, you know, what will the catalyst be for that kind of interest in emerging markets in Asia to return? I mean, obviously you're invested there the whole time, but when we look at foreign investors in general, would it be a change or a peak in the Fed hiking cycle? Would it be, you know, signs of stabilization in China? or is it not so easy to discern necessarily what might eventually cause a swing in interest?
I don't think it's easy to discern, because you're absolutely right. There's been very limited interest from outside the region in the region for quite a while now. And of course, when it happens, people will ascribe it to, yes, it was because of interest rates or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think it's possibly more likely to happen after a period of very strong performance. I've been rather disappointed, maybe is the wrong word, but interested at how many people are actually momentum investors. Rather than fundamental investors. So if Asia has a nice run for whatever reasons, you'll then find people sort of jumping on the bandwagon, as we've seen happen many a time over the years. Yeah. And nobody's on that bandwagon at the moment. So when it will happen, I have absolutely no idea. And we're just watching earnings come through. So ultimately, share prices will be driven by earnings.
Yeah, as you say, I think we're approaching the end of the year now, and it's always this kind of time of year, and people start debating whether next year will be one for emerging markets and for Asia Pacific. So hope springs eternal on that front, I imagine. But we reached the end of our time. Hugh, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us today. It's been great to chat about all these issues, and we hope you've enjoyed it, listeners, as well. Thank you and goodbye.